Good morning. So last time we finished up talking about scheduling. So we talked about another proportional scare scheduler besides the lottery scheduler, which was Linux's scheduler. And it was deterministic and it tracked this notion of virtual time, which was basically how long did each program run on the CPU for. And it just said, if you had the least time, you're the most deserving because we want to be fair. We give you the CPU next. And there were some adjustments. So we weighted the processes based on importance, which is based on actually nice level in Linux. And we dealt with things like whatever process was waiting for a while and came back, we adjusted its virtual time to not give it too much of an advantage. Then we talked about real-time scheduling, which is where you have typically physically determined deadlines. And you don't just want to do the best thing, you want to provide some guarantees that there's some constraints you actually want to meet based on the real world. And the simplest algorithm when you're dealing with real time, assuming you can implement it, is earliest deadline first. If you just know all the deadlines and can look at them when you're running, you just run what's earliest. And that's not necessarily the same as minimizing response time, because things which have quicker deadlines are going to run faster than they might otherwise run, even with something that optimizes for response time. And if you do this right, you can figure out, okay, what's the worst case? And you want to do this in advance when you have something like the computer for a car, and you want to say, when you build the car, yes, I will always respond to you pressing the brake within the deadline. We talked about threading. So we've been back to the idea of multi-threaded processes, where we have shared memory, files, everything, but the things which were specific to running on the CPU, which was basically our registers and the stack we were accessing, were shared. And even the stacks were in the same memory space. It's just that we had pointers to different stacks and different sets of registers, one for each thread. And we looked at the pthread API. The two big functions were create and join. Create, make a new thread. Join is the equivalent of wait for a thread to finish, retrieve its return value. We also looked at detach, which is how you say, hey, I don't want to wait for this thread, just let it run and free up its resources when it's done. I'm not going to join it. So any questions about what we talked about last time? Okay, so via anonymous feedback, there was a question about, he asked me to explain this quiz question. So the XP sketch scheduler scans the proc table looking for a ready to run process. And the question says that this is slow, and if you have thousands of processes, it's not going to scale. So what, and it's asking for a faster alternative. So a subtle thing, which I think is probably one of the things which trip people up in this question, is that when we look for a ready to run process, we take the first ready to run process. So it's not scalable to thousands of processes, assuming most are not, assuming many are not runnable, which is typically true. If we have thousands of processes, probably like maybe, even if like 50% of them are doing I/O at any given time, that's 500 processes doing I/O. And it's probably gonna be much higher than that. If we have thousands of processes, probably gonna be like 90% or something. And sort of the time we need to wait is we need to like scan through the list until we find the first runnable one. So that's based on what proportion, how many we have to skip over on average. So 50% of the runnable, we'll skip over one. That's not so bad. If 90%, well, it depends how many there are, and that becomes, we'll skip over 9 on average. And when we have a system with thousands of processes, typically we don't have thousands of cores. And if we're utilizing our system well, typically a vast majority of them will be waiting for typically I/O. Because if you think of like what sort of scenarios where would you have thousands of processes, like one of them is that you have thousands of users. And if all of you are logged into the lab machines via SSH, probably you're not all running things that actually use the CPU most of the time. So we have thousands of most likely waiting processes. And the question had a bunch of options. So one was randomly select a task to run and run it. Well, not all the tasks are runnable. So if we're just selecting a task at random from the array we have, we're typically not going to find a runnable one, and we're going to have the same sort of problem that we have to look at several, and it's not going to be any faster. And if we do have an efficient way to select from the runnable tasks, well, we didn't have this problem of scanning in the first place. Second option is to maintain a hash table of ready-to-run processes keyed on their priority. So this, if we have lots of high unused priorities, this is going to be pretty inefficient, especially since scanning the hash table, we're accessing memory in random order, so it's pretty cache unfriendly. And if we have lots of priorities, you know, we could be scanning through a lot of priorities where there happens not to be a process right now. That's not very efficient. One option is to maintain a stack of proc table pointers, so presumably process pointers, and pop the process to run from them and push them when they become ready to run. So this is fast. Like, we find a process to run really quickly. We just pop from a stack. The problem is that this has a really, really bad starvation. Now, if you think about this, I run my program, and my program finishes its time slice. I push it because it's still runnable. I pop it, I'm still running it. I'm never going to switch away from a program with this policy. So it's just a really bad scheduler for actually getting things done, because we're gonna be guaranteed to have really bad starvation. And so the option that was correct was maintain a linked list of ready to run processes and always run the first process on the list. So selecting a process is we look at the head pointer of the linked list, that's the process to run, and we also update the head pointer, which is also just look at the next pointer, set it to the head. And place newly ready processes at the end, so whenever we change a process's state from to runnable, we just add it to the end of the linked list. We presumably have a tail pointer, so that's also constant time, no matter how many processes we have. Any questions on this? So why don't I go on to a corrected version of the example from last time, or at least partly corrected, because I needed to remember how join actually works. And this was broken because of this, that we're returning a pointer to our stack. So one way we could fix this is by, say, returning a something allocated on the heap. And that would be fine. Yeah. So would you have to deallocate that in the end? Yes, you would want to then deallocate that. So we'd have probably a delete string pointer. And because all these threads share all the memory, so it's not that result was a pointer, the problem wasn't that result wasn't the pointer that made sense in main, it was the pointer to a stack that was deallocated. So, you know, we had a stack there, it got deallocated when we joined the thread, so this is where our string pointer pointed. But when we allocated something on the heap, it's the same heap for both threads. You know, it's fine to share pointers between them. So that will work fine. So other questions on this example? And last time we went through a couple of examples of, you know, passing things to threads. I'm going to review that quickly just to make sure we're okay before we move on to talking about actually doing more complicated things between threads. So here's an example where I have an array and I have this sumThread function which takes an ID and sums one half of the array, depending on whether the ID is 0 or 1. And it's a global array, and that is, and the, also it stores as results in this results array, and that's fine. These are shared between all the threads, so we can write results in the thread, read it in main, that'll work. And note that we're reading it after rejoin, so you don't have to worry about, is it written yet? We know it's written because join is returned, even though we aren't using the return value. So questions on this? So another thing we can do is we could say, why don't we just have some structure we pass to the thread. I guess I should have a void cast here. And it's going to take that, that has the start and end, and it's going to add its up its sum, and it's going to store it back in that struct for us. And we'll just allocate this on the stack in main. So our array is still global, but we have this pointer to sum all stack that we pass to the thread, and that's no problem because when the entire time the thread's running, because we wait for it to finish, that's still allocated, and we can have, and it's in the same memory space. And we then use this, so we write to that pointer and we can read our result out at the end from that local variable of sum that we just passed a pointer to. Any questions on this? And we can extend this idea because maybe you remember from earlier courses being told not to use global variables, which I'm doing in all my examples. So we can easily use this same idea to not use a global variable. We can just, in addition to passing the start and end location in that structure, we can pass a pointer to the array we want the thread to use. And now we've gotten rid of global variables by just passing it as an argument, just like you would for a non-thread function. But we still have this case that have something which is a local variable of sumAll, which is only okay because sumAll waits. It waits for the thread to finish, so we're not accessing that thing through a pointer after it's deallocated from the stack. So let's say instead we wanted to have a function like sumAll where we split it into pieces. We had one function which started this summing and one function which finished it. So maybe we could do something while the sum is happening. You know, because the sum is happening in other threads, those threads will run, say, on another core. If we have more than 1,024 numbers, like, you know, a billion, that might take a while. So you want to start it, and then later wait for it to finish. Well, in that case, we can't have our info on the stack, so we could do the same thing and allocate it on the heap. We could just, same idea. We have a function which allocates it on the heap. We keep track of it, use it later, and we can in fact also use the same space to say, remember our thread IDs. So we can join the threads later because we need to wait for the threads to finish just in case they took a while, like they got starved because our schedule was bad. So we can know we can read the results. Any questions about any of these examples? Okay. Okay, so we've looked at sort of simple cases of, you know, this is a simple program where we have threads, they compute something, they finish, and that's when we get the answer. And this is a case where, well, because we're waiting for the threads to finish, we don't have to worry much about when exactly does the thread do its work. We just know it does it sometime before it finishes, and we just don't look at its result before then. The thread is reading stuff that's not being changed, so everything's nice and simple. But in real programs, often you want your threads to read from an array which, you know, maybe isn't left unchanged the entire time the thread is running. And this makes figuring out whether code is correct a lot harder. And the big issue is that all the schedulers we talked about tend to introduce non-determinism. Sometimes this is obvious, like with our lottery scheduler, it's really obvious that it's non-deterministic. Like, it does the different things every time. But even schedulers which are less random, less explicitly random, tend to introduce non-determinism because like what they do depends exactly on like when the disk finishes doing what its thing or when you press keys. That determines the schedule. So as far as programs are concerned, it's basically random. Like you don't know when users are pressing keys, and that affects what gets scheduled when because it changes the order in which those lists are, exactly when the timer interrupt gets to happen, and so on. And this is worse on multiple cores because different cores might be running at slightly different speeds, especially because of things like caches. And this is a real problem for writing threaded code. This means that testing threaded code is pretty hard, because you can't reliably trigger all the possible scenarios. You can't even, you know, if you think of one thing that could happen, like even that's hard to reliably trigger. Like one order in which threads could execute, there's not a good way of doing that. It's like you can, it's just very awkward. So when you're writing threaded code, you should be thinking about, you know, designing for correctness. I'm mentioning this because, you know, you want to consider what the possibilities are in design, and you want to write your code in a way where it's easy to see that bad things are not possible. Because testing is not going to tell you what goes on. Like, this is, you know, you might think, like, when you have a seg fault, like, what your code does is kind of unpredictable. This is way worse. So we're going to start looking at the problem of I have multiple threads acting on the same thing, and I have this non-determinism. How do I deal with that when I'm not doing something as simple as the threads are just going to read something and compute a result and finish? And we're going to do the classic example, which is obvious as far as correctness properties, which is an ATM server. So this is taking commands from a lot of ATMs, let's say. The commands are like withdraw and deposit, and we need to keep track of all the balances, and we have some correctness goals, and one of the most important ones is that we don't want to lose money. You know, that we want to account properly, you know, that if you withdraw twice, we want to actually withdraw that, you know, withdraw $100 twice, we want to draw with $200 from your account, not 100, or 0, or some other number. And if you deposit twice, we want to deposit the sum of those two deposits into your account, not 0, or only one of them. So So let's say we have our deposit function here. This is like the pseudocode for our server. So we have this infinite loop. We receive a request. We look at the operation. If it's deposit, we run this code, which gets an account, which is some structure that's in memory. Maybe sometimes get account like loads it from disk if we need to. And we update the balance and we store it. And obviously this is oversimplified because there's presumably other things we'd be checking, but this is the basic operation. So any questions on this problem setup I have here? Okay. And let's say we want to do this in multiple threads. Let's say maybe get account and store account. Sometimes they're slow. Like sometimes they like communicate over the network or read from disk. Every once in a while, that might be a reason. Or maybe we have, you know, a million deposits to do per day, and we don't want to just use one core for that. Whatever the reason, let's assume we have many threads all running this same loop. So we have this loop, and we're just running it from lots of threads at the same time. You know, so we just created a whole bunch of copies of a loop, one in each thread. And they're just going to run independently, and for the most part, the threads are independent, because usually we won't get a request to deposit to the same account, or withdraw, or so on. So this setup makes sense.
Why do we create a new thread of the loop instead of creating a thread of like the operation?
So the question is, why would you create a thread for the loop instead of a thread for each operation? So creating a thread is going to have some cost. So I mentioned, like, for example, in Linux, threads are a special case of processes, basically. So you have most of the cost of creating a process. You need to create that new structure. You need to create some space in the kernel to store registers. Each of these threads is going to need to be scheduled. So there's going to be some real cost to starting a thread. And I guess also you have to allocate space for the stack, so that's a big mount call, and possibly other things you'll need to allocate. So usually we want to try to allocate fewer threads on the assumption that there's some cost to allocating threads. The other reason why you might do this is if we started building this server, we probably already have server loop written. And it's really easy just to run it in separate threads compared to changing all the cases of the server loop function to spot threads. But both are valid designs. Just typically people will have the loop running in a thread because they don't want to be starting and stopping threads all the time. Because that's not so fast, not as fast as you could be. So, yeah, I'm assuming we're doing this. So let's say we have two threads, they access the same account. And we're doing a deposit, two deposits to the same account. So we get the same account pointer. And here's my pseudo assembly. So thread A, it moves the account balance into RAX. It adds the amount to RAX. Then, oh, interrupt happens. Oh, context switch, run some other program. And now we're running thread B. Thread B moves the account balance into its RAX, which is different from thread A's. It adds the amount to RAX. And then, oops, you know, some IO happened, you ran something else, then the scheduler figured out what to run, and eventually switched back to thread A. And now thread A is running, and it says, oh, I have RAX here. I just added to it, all set. I can just put that in the account balance. We're all ready. Store that there. You know, and then we context switch again. Eventually we get back to thread B, and thread B says, oh, I just added my amount to RAX. I'm ready to put that into the account balance, and we're all set. And we have a lost write. So thread A wrote to the account balance, that write was successful, and immediately overwritten. So thread B1, its deposit is the only one which counted. And so this is a scenario we want to avoid. And we kind of previewed the solution. We talked briefly about locks. When we mentioned that the thing the scheduler uses, that's the sort of thing we're going to want to use. You want only one thread at a time to manipulate this balance. And the reason why it's problematic to have two of them is that even though our code has a plus equals operation, we know that that often doesn't compile into just one thing that happens at a time. And note that in this case, we don't even need multiple cores. You know, what I'm showing you here, this timeline could happen on a single core. We just need to have like key presses and network activity happen at exactly the right times to cause this sort of set of context switches to happen. And on multiple cores, it's even more likely that we'll have problems because, you know, we can have these running at the same time without context switches in between. And just have them interleave that way. So questions on our lost write? Okay, so let's think about these races. So we'll call these race conditions when we have two things trying to update the same value at the same time. And we'll try to do some simple examples. So here, let's say x and y are both zero initially, and thread A assigns 1 to x, thread B assigns 2 to y. What are the possible values of x after this runs? After both threads finish. This is not a trick question. This is an easy question. 1. There's only one possibility. Thread B doesn't interfere with x. That's our simple case. How about this one? Thread A writes y plus 1 to x, and thread B writes 2 to y, then y times 2 to y. What are the possible values of x? And they're initially 0 before all the threads run. So check if you agree with your neighbors about the possible values. Okay, someone have an answer to volunteer? Okay.
1, 3, and 5.
Yeah, so we have 1, 3, or 5. We can have 1 if we run A first and then we do all of B. So X becomes 0 plus 1. We can run Y equals 2, and then we can run switch and run 2 plus 1 and get 3. We can run y gets 2, then y gets 2 times 2 in thread B, and then we can run x equals 4 plus 1. So those are our possible values. Okay. So how about this one? Thread A assigns 1 to x, thread B assigns 2 to x. What are the possible values? After both threads finish. Someone have an answer they want to defend? What are the possible values here? Yeah. So 1 or 2. Yeah. And that's what makes the most sense. So there is a subtlety to point out here. So why didn't you want to say 3? You just intuitively said, well, we just assign the whole value at once, but maybe we assign each bit at a time. But you have reasons to believe that probably that's not how things work. Like, you know that the move instruction isn't move into bit 0, then move into bit 1. So you probably think, yeah, these happen at the same time. You know, this assignment, we assign the whole thing or nothing. We don't assign the last bit and then, you know, the second to last bit or something like that. And you think of these assignments, they either happen or they happen all at once or they don't happen. You don't think that assigning two is something which, you know, is some operation which gets split into pieces, and some of those pieces can happen and some don't. So this notion is known as an atomic operation. So you're thinking, when you say it's one or two, that the assignment is atomic. It happens, runs to completion, or not at all. Like, it does its whole thing, you know, runs to completion without interruption. That's important. We don't have some sort of partially done operation that we can see. And these are the operations we'll use to have things work together. So runs to completion without interruption. So, you know, all at once or not at all is the notion. So it either happens all at once or it doesn't happen at all. Like, that's how the atomic operation happens. So we can still have the lost write in this case. Like, one of these writes we don't see the result of, but we don't see half of one and half of the other. We see the whole thing or nothing. Because the whole write happens and then another whole write hides it. So the whole thing happens all together. We don't have some sort of, we do half the write, then something else happens, then we do the second half of the write. We let the whole thing run all the way before anything else happens. And in most machines, loading or storing words, whatever the machine considers its native value size, is atomic. I say most, not guaranteed. So we can't get 3 on most machines when you compile the code in the natural way and assign 1 and 2. So usually it works the way you expect, that we don't actually turn this assignment into writing each bit separately and have things get split up. So you might say, okay, and the way you probably think about this is, well, it's one move, that move either happens or it doesn't. That makes sense, that's how instructions work. You run each instruction one at a time. And that would be a nice simple model to have, that you can just, you know, think of if it's an instruction, it either happens completely or it doesn't. This is not how real machines work. So for example, on x86, the add instruction, when you're writing, adding to memory, is not atomic. On multiple cores, it is possible to see the add not completely take partial effect. And I'll have an example that illustrates this. So here's some code. I have a thread I'm running, which is running this update loop up here. So I have a global variable called the value, and I run this add instruction to add 1 to it. So that's one instruction, really is one instruction. I don't have the sort of load into REX, add to REX store. Like, it's one instruction, but the way it's implemented on x86 is essentially the load into REX, add to REX store sort of thing. Like, that's what the processor does internally. So the read and write is atomic, like it reads the whole value at once and writes the whole value at once. We don't have any sort of bit-by-bit things, but it's actually divided up into read, add, store. That's how it's implemented, even though it's one instruction. So I have this code here where I start this loop, and I'm saying run this a million times in 2 threads. And so if the add was atomic, if it happened entirely at once, we'd expect the total sum to be 2 million, because each thread would add a million times, each of those adds would happen without interruption, so they get to read the value, add to it, store the new value. So we get a result of 2 million. So I ran this on my machine, which has multiple cores, which is important. I don't think you'd get the results I'm showing you on a single core, because you can't interrupt, do half of the instruction on a single core. But on multiple cores, 2 adds are running at the same time. So it doesn't matter that you can't have an interrupt, like a key press can't start the OS in the middle of an ad. But it doesn't matter because the two ads are running at the same time without running the OS. So here are is a histogram of the results I got. Notice that the peak is around 1 million. And what probably happened is that the processor ran the load and the add, but deferred the stores until way later. Yeah?
Why is this good?
Why is this good?
Why is this what we do?
Why is this what we do? So this is a lot. So the question is, why does the processor work this way? So if you remember from 30 through 30, when we talked about things like caches, and you know, we want to like store the value in the cache, and, you know, store it eventually. And when we talked about out-of-order execution in pipelines, we kind of want to defer writing to the cache until we need to keep the values around. And that's what the processor is doing here. Is that we're writing a value to the cache. And probably what's happening is we're saying, okay, you just updated that value. I'm not going to send it back to the other core yet, because that would be expensive. I'm just going to keep my updated version and get rid of it later. So probably what's happening here is the processor updates its value in its that core's cache and says, well, I don't need to send this out yet. And in the case where values aren't shared, that's much faster, right? Because writing a value to the memory system or the next level of cache is going to be very slow. And that's why I think the processor is doing this. And if you remember write-back caches from 30 through 30 or wherever architecture course you took, you remember that we want to defer writing when we're updating a value over and over again, and that's exactly what we're doing here. Yeah?
Is this like a niche problem, or does it like happen on any program that we ever run?
So the question is this a problem, a niche problem, or does it happen all the time? It happens all the time. So we're going to tell you some things that are safe to use to coordinate between threads. If you don't use them, there are lots of cases for you to get things like this happening. Yeah, and what's happening here to make the value so off is obviously like surprisingly complicated. And we'll talk about, probably not today, about how things, a little more about the typical processor implementation to keep values in sync. But the issue is that like that doesn't take effect unless you use instructions which explicitly say, yes, I want this value in sync, or yes, I want the things I wrote earlier to actually be visible before I execute these other reads. So this is what happens if you do the naive act. So they get split up, even though, so the stores for one happen after the others. So we get these lost writes. In fact, we get way, way more lost writes than you'd intuitively think. And I think that's probably just because the processor is saying, oh, this value has been recently updated, and you're still updating it. I'm not going to write it back yet. And I think that's what the processor is doing. So it's just deferring writing it back because it knows it's still being updated, because that's usually faster, except for these correctness issues. OK. So. You may ask, what is actually atomic? For now, we'll assume loads and stores of words are atomic. In general, the processor designer will tell you what's atomic. And I'm saying for now we'll assume because, yes, they're atomic, but not in the way you want. We'll talk about why later. But we'll assume they're atomic in the intuitive way that they happen in the order you expect and all at once. And we're going to say, given that, like we're going to figure out how can we solve this synchronization problem. And later on we'll deal with the fact that they're not, But helpfully, the processor designer will also tell us a solution where they'll say, here's some special instructions which give you the all-at-once property you want. And we're going to use those. So the processor designer is going to tell us, these are when my instruction, which instructions, you know, won't be interrupted by another core, will happen all at once. Use those instructions and everything will work the way you want. You know, and their job is to design the caches to work as documented, and hopefully they'll give us something actually useful. So I'm going to start with a sort of human-motivated example, which is in the textbook, for figuring out how to coordinate. And this is the problem of roommates Alice and Bob. Alice and Bob want to keep a fridge stocked with milk. So Alice looks in the fridge, there's no milk. Alice says, okay, better buy some milk, goes to the store. Alice arrives in the store, Bob arrives home, looks in the fridge, oh, there's no milk, he goes to leave for the store, and then now they have more milk than they wanted. So how should Alice and Bob coordinate better? How do you avoid this problem? Yes. Yeah, so just write a note. That's the natural solution. And we can think of writing a note in terms of atomic loads and stores as set a flag and have everyone read the flag to figure out, is someone buying milk? And that seems like a logical solution. So leave a note saying, I am buying milk. You place before buying, you remove when you're done, and you don't try buying if there's a note. You know, and that's like set note equal one, if no, no, you know. It's atomic store, right? An atomic load to read it. And we know that they're atomic. So that seems like a good solution. So let's try using that to solve this problem. So here's our code. If there's no milk, we check if there's milk. If there's no milk, then we check, is there no note? If so, we leave a note, we buy some milk, and remove the note. And it turns out that this doesn't work. So what happens? And this is what happens is Alice looks for some milk, says, oh, nope, there's no milk. Looks for a note, nope, no note. Alice starts writing her note. Meanwhile, Bob says, hi, Alice, looks for some milk. says no, starts writing the note. And now we still have too much milk being bought. So obviously there's something going on here which humans wouldn't do, but these are like literally following the instructions we have written down that check for a note. You know, we don't have this extra, if you're waving hi to the roommate, maybe they're writing a note, maybe you shouldn't do it. But you know, that's not one of these steps. So how can we fix this and get our computer instructions to match our intuition about what should happen? Back there?
What if we lock the fridge?
So lock the fridge? Okay, so when do we lock the fridge? So after we realize there's no milk, we lock the fridge, okay. So what's gonna, do I have a blank slide? No, but, so you're saying that if we have, so you're saying that the algorithm is, if no milk, then we lock fridge, you know, just a crude solution, because we've known about locks, and then buy milk, and unlock. And then that's it. This is your algorithm?
Yes.
Okay. So this is what Alice is doing. And Bob at this point says, oh, if there's no milk, I'm gonna lock the fridge. I'm gonna buy some milk and then I'm gonna unlock the fridge. And Alice can say, I can't lock the fridge yet, I'll do it later. And we still have too much milk. Yeah. Okay, so if we had some way of making writing the note and checking for milk atomic, That would be great. So that would be sort of, and in the computer world, we consider that sort of an example of atomic load and stores aren't enough, let's give it more powerful operation. And that's actually the solution we'll end up going to. The more powerful operation won't look like that, just because it's not the easiest thing to implement in hardware is like read two values. But yes, we'll actually be doing something like that. That's a good idea. But there turns out there is a way of solving it with just atomic loads and stores, though it is not obvious and not what we'll end up actually doing on real machines. Yeah?
Can you just write a note before you open the fridge?
Okay, so we store a note before we open the fridge. That seems like a good idea. It will solve the problem of buying too much milk, and indeed, it will. So we just leave a note, we check if there's no milk. Or we do this some other way. So like this solution doesn't work because we're leaving a note then checking if there's no note, and there's always a note. So that's not quite what we want to do. But we can do a version of that where we know who the note's from. So like we have, instead of having one note memory location, we have one note for Alice, note for Bob. So, you know, and we say, leave a note from Alice, and if there's no note from Bob, then I actually buy the note. So this, it turns out, also doesn't work, so what's the problem? Yeah. So they can both write a note at the same time, yeah. So we can end up with something like this, where Alice leaves a note, Alice looks in the fridge, checks if there's milk, checks if there's a note from Bob, but Bob just wrote a note, has posted it, and is ready to look at the fridge, but hasn't yet. So yep, there's a note, well, not gonna buy milk, Bob has it taken care of. You know, and then eventually she gets around to removing her note, but in the meanwhile, Bob says, oh, there's no milk. Oh, there's still a note from Alice. Alice must have taken care of it. So I'm not gonna buy milk. And then it turns out we buy less milk than we want. Okay, any other modifications to fix this? Yeah.
There's no milk, Alice kills Bob.
Okay. That's not one of the operations we wanted to use. So there's a way of doing this with checking notes. Notes and checking notes. It turns out. But it is not at all obvious. And not elegant either. So here is one what I think is a solution. You probably have some things you don't like about this from an elegance perspective, like that the code for Alice and Bob are different. Which is basically something all the solutions to this problem need to do. So they need to be different, like at least they need to have like a different ID number to make it work. So this is pretty ugly. We also haven't dealt with problems like what if we want to buy milk again a second time? How do we repeat this? And it's actually really hard to prove that this is correct or not. And it's also, you know, pretty hard to figure out, okay, what if we have three people? Now what do we do? So there is a solution to this. Peterson's algorithm is the general version. Wikipedia has it. You can look it up. We'll use special hardware support instead, both because this sort of thing is really awkward to figure out, And it doesn't generalize to like more cores, and because it turns out that hardware doesn't quite work the way we want, so we want need special hardware support anyways, just to get the sort of atomic note leaving we want to work correctly, like you saw with that add loop example. Okay, so let's talk about how we actually build locks. First, I'm going to do some definitions of some terms that will come up all the time. So mutual exclusion means ensuring only one thread does a particular thing at a time. In our example, we wanted to have the checking and buying milk to be only done by one person at a time. And a critical section is the name we're going to use for some piece of code which is executed with mutual exclusion, where only one thread does that piece of code at a time. That piece of code is called a critical section. And a lock is an object only one thread can hold at a time. This is an interface for implementing critical sections, or mutual exclusion. And we saw, like briefly, in the XP6 code, we had this acquire release. And that was getting a lock, say, on our process table, so we were the only thread accessing it. So making what was in between a critical section that only one thread would do at a time. So let's talk about locks. So lock is an object which has two operations. So it has an operation to lock or acquire. You'll see both names. I'll use them interchangeably, probably, because XP6 uses acquire, pthreads uses lock. But they mean the same thing. And an operation to unlock or release the lock. And the way we implement our critical section is we acquire the lock or lock the lock. Then we do all our operations. You want to have only one thread do at a time, in this case checking for milk and buying milk if any is missing. Questions here? Yeah.
So if somebody's already locked and you want to lock it again, that process has to wait until they're locked to lock it?
Yes. So the question is, so we have this interface here. What happens if someone else, if, you know, this is what Alice is doing, what happens if Bob comes along and tries to lock here? The lock is not going to return until after the unlock. So lock will wait, it will do something. Hopefully it will let other things run, but our simplest locks won't do that, although just waste CPU time. But they won't return until the lock is unlocked. And if it's never unlocked, they'll never return from the lock operation. Other questions? Okay. So pthreads provides a lock called a mutex. Mutex for mutual exclusion. And it has a type pthread mutex t. It has an init function which initializes it like a constructor, because this is a C API, so there are no constructors. And this null argument is attributes like we saw for the thread. We probably won't ever use them, but there are settings you can set. Probably the most notable is that you can set an error checking mutex, which will return in useful error codes if you do bad things. If you check the return value of pthread mutex lock and unlock, it will like return if you're doing something that you shouldn't be doing, like unlocking an already unlocked mutex. So our lock operation locks the lock, our unlock operation unlocks it. And I probably shouldn't have this here because I can't make slot. probably I did that wrong. Let me make sure. Yeah. Nope, I didn't do that wrong. Okay. That actually is what the API is. Okay, so it actually takes a pointer to the lock for reasons of not being consistent with what pthread join does. Okay, so it takes a pointer to the lock, all these functions do. That's how it works. So questions on this? Did not make it. So that's the pthread mutex API. We also have locks in XV6. They're called spin locks. We'll see why they're called spin locks later. And this is the API for that. There's acquire and release. The initlock function takes a name, which is just used for debugging. So like some error messages that get printed out if you use locks incorrectly by the XV6 kernel use that name. Yeah?
If you forget to unlock, are all the threads stuck?
The question is, if you forget to unlock the lock, are all the threads stuck? Yes. And it's actually, and it might be worse for XV6 because of how XV6 implements this lock.
Even after like a thread terminates, does it unlock? It's still locked.
Even after a thread?
Thread A.
Oh, so the question is, what happens if I have a lock, a thread terminates, is the lock still held? Yes. In XV6, definitely yes. In pthreads, yes, and you're not allowed to do that. Pthreads has a rule that you aren't allowed to unlock a mutex from a different thread than you lock it, so I think it's undefined. Like, some lock implementations might do something wrong in the case where the thread terminates without unlocking. Okay. See locks here, and these are our primary mechanism for keeping weird things from happening. So whenever you're accessing shared data, you basically should use a lock. So let's talk about, as a specific example, C++ containers and locking, things like vector. You want to use vector for multiple threads, what can you safely do? And that depends on how it's implemented. So vector, we think, okay, it's a dynamically allocated array. And it's reallocated on size changes. And that reallocation is actually pretty dangerous. If we're reading from the old version, and then it's reallocated to a new version, now we're reading from freed memory. So we need to keep that from happening. So the rule for vector is you can access it from multiple threads as long as it's not being resized. If it's not being resized, as long as you're accessing different parts of the vector, so it's like accessing an array, no problem. You're accessing the same part, you have to use something like a lock to make sure that two threads aren't trying to touch it at the same time. And the general rules for containers, and this applies to most other things you'll deal with, is that multiple threads can read anything at the same time. If you're only reading, it's fine. And this is even true for C++ containers, even though, you know, you could think maybe they're using a splay tree, well, they're not allowed to, unless they make it work correctly with multiple threads. I'm saying a splay tree, if you remember from 2150, a splay tree updates on reads. You can only read an element if no other thread is modifying it. If a thread is modifying it, if you haven't guaranteed that the thread is not modifying it at the same time, you can't read it. That's the rule. If you try to read it, what result you get is unspecified. You get any weird value, including ones which don't make any sense. This is especially true when it's like not an int, like it's something which needs to be written in multiple pieces. Because there's multiple move instructions, you might see only some of them. And generally, you can only add or remove elements if no other threads are accessing it. And the same sort of rules apply to just like normal variables. You can read, multiple threads can read from them at the same time. If anyone's writing, you better use something like a lock. This makes sense? Okay, so we know about using locks. So this is using it. Let's talk about how do we actually implement locks. And we're going to start with the simplest case for implementing locks, which is what if we don't have multi-core? Multi-core makes everything much more complicated. So we just have a single core, and we need to implement locks in a single core. And what we need to worry about is some other thing is going to update our isItLock flag while we're like trying to read it. So our solution is that, well, when do other things run on a single core? It's when we have an interrupt, like a timer interrupt or a key press interrupt. And if you remember from earlier, we can temporarily disable interrupts, which we use, for example, when we are writing the trap frame to avoid getting confused in the middle of that. And we can just use this to implement locks on a single core. So just disable interrupts, don't have to worry about anything else running, and on unlock, we can rename. And x86 has instructions to do this. These instructions only work in kernel mode, but we need locks in the kernel. This seems like a way of implementing them, if you have only a single core. Okay. And we could just export this as our locking API. So, does that seem like, you know, let's say this is our implementation of locks. To take care of them being kernel mode, maybe these are system calls. And we don't even need a specific lock variable, we just, you know, enable the same. So, what are some issues with this that are going to be problematic? Yeah?
Can you take advantage of it? If you're like a coder, you can just lock your thing and you ensure that your program is never interrupted.
Yeah, so one problem is that we can hang the system with this. So in the kernel, this might be fine because we know as the operating system author that I wrote code which properly unlocks things. But if we're exporting this as an API for normal programs, that's real bad. The user can hang the system on purpose or even by accident. Like you accidentally write an infinite loop. Now you can't press Control C because interrupts are disabled, so key presses don't do anything. Okay, there's some other problems with this. Other things that don't work very well that we might want to have work with locks. Any? Ideas? Yeah. So one thing is, let's say I acquire a lock, and one of the things I want to do while I acquire a lock on my bank account object. I have a lock for it, so I lock, and then I want to read in the amount to deposit from the user. So I call read, I try to have my process wait for an interrupt from a key press to happen, but we've disabled interrupts. So that's a bit of a problem, you know, or if we like read from disk. Now that read can't complete because it needs an interrupt to let the OS know the read is done, and we've disabled reception of interrupts, so it can't work anymore. And there's another issue, which is, what if we have nested locks? If this is our implementation of unlock, then we enable interrupts too early, so we need to do some counting for nested locks. Okay. Questions on these issues? So, despite these issues, x86's spin lock, one of the things it does is it does disable interrupts. And in the code, you see there's a acquire starts with this push CLI, and this pop C, and release ends with this pop CLI. And that's a utility function, which the push CLI disables interrupts, pop CLI enables interrupts again, and they appear in pairs. And the way push CLI actually works is it disables interrupts, assuming they're not already disabled, and pop CLI enables interrupts if the corresponding pair disabled them. So this allows nested locks to work. So we just track how many locks deep are we, and if we're not at the top level, we don't re-enable interrupts. So this is one of the things that XV6 uses to implement locks. So this is the part for the single core case. And this avoids like an interrupt starting something else interfering with what we have locked. You know, so we're manipulating some process table, an interrupt happens, we don't want that to interfere. There's another part of lock implementation I'll get to probably next time, which is dealing with the multi-core case. What if something's running on another core where interrupts still work and it wants to access the same thing? How do we keep that from happening? I'm going to talk about that part next time. But if XV6 was a single core only, this is all we need to implement locks on it. Yeah?
How does that solve the first problem?
So it how does it solve the hang the system problem? It doesn't. XV6's solution to the hang the system problem is that these are locks that the kernel uses, and we trust the people who wrote the kernel to not hang the system. So we'll talk about also a smarter solution for locks where we don't hang the system later on. Okay. Other questions about this lock implementation? Okay. So I'd like to talk about, you know, so we talked about atomic loads and stores as a way of implementing locks when we were working between different threads on different cores. So I'm going to talk about how we do locks on multi-core, and start talking about it today and finish it up next Tuesday. And we're also talk about what, how do multiple cores actually coordinate? Like they have a shared memory, but they have independent caches. So how do we keep those caches in sync? And that's an important consideration as far as like when do loads and stores happen? So if everything went to a shared memory, it would be very simple, right? We just expect, you know, if a load instruction immediately loaded from the memory every time, immediately without a cache, without waiting, everything would be nice and simple. This is not how processors work. And they do non-intuitive things. So for example, here's some code. I have a variable x and y. I set x to 1, move y into the return value. I set y to 1, move x into the return value. These are just two functions, okay? So we expect three possible results. So one result is that we execute this move, then this move, then this, then this, and we get 1 and 1. Like these threads are perfectly synchronized, that's the result we get. And the assumption is that this load writes a value into shared memory, this reads that value, and these happen in lockstep. If these don't happen in lockstep, maybe thread A executes first. So thread A sets x to 1, reads 0, which is the initial value set before we start the thread. Or vice versa, thread B sets y to 1, reads 0. So those are the results we expect. And every other result doesn't seem like it makes sense. This clear to everyone? And if the system, if loads and stores were atomic in the way we wanted, this is exactly what, how things would work. These would be our three possible results, depending on whether they ran in lockstep, you know, or one ran before the other. So this is a real program. I can execute it. So I ran this on my desktop, and I ran this 100 million times. And here are my results. So over 99 million of those times, A executed before B. So I got A0, B1. About 170,000 of those times, B executed before A. So I got A of 1, A returned 1, Y was 1, B returned 0, X was 0. So yeah, B set Y to 1, returned 0, then A set X to 1, returned that 1 from B. About 4,000 times, 5,000 times, I got the interleaving, that the both moves happened. It's as if the move, two moves happened, and then the reads, so both of them read, the others write. And about 394 times, well, exactly 394 times in this case, I got both zero. And that is not a processor bug and not a compiler bug. This is documented behavior if you read the Intel manuals very closely. They just say that this happens. That's, yeah.
Is it because of the cache thing?
The question is this because of the cache thing? So that would be an intuition for, yeah, sort of what's happening. It's partly related to how the cache works. This issue is called load and store reordering. So it's more related to out of order execution. That if you remember, we want to execute, these processors like have a pipeline, we want to execute multiple instructions at once, and we actually execute the instructions in a different order. So like if we have a store, we want to do it later. And the processor can move the store loads and stores loads around when it's executing instructions. It doesn't execute the loads in order, just like it doesn't execute instructions in order in general. So the processor does this reordering just because it wants to say, if I have a value, I want to do that instruction now. And this reordering applies to loads and stores. So if we have a load, the value isn't available in cache now, we'll finish it later. Now, if the processor did this willy-nilly, you get wrong answers from your normal assembly code all the time. So the processor has many rules about when it executes loads and stores to keep that from happening. But every processor I know of doesn't have those rules make it so multiple cores do the right thing if they're executing at the same time. So on a single core, like it will guarantee that it's not going to reorder your loads and stores, so you get the wrong answer in your single core on your single thread. But on multiple cores, it might reorder some of the loads, so you get something weird happening. And what's probably happening here is that we do this read, that these two reads get moved earlier than the writes. That the reads happen earlier, the writes are delayed, because the cache was a bit slow some of the time, and that's what happened. And the processor could have said, I'm not going to do this, but that would be slow, so they didn't. So they said, allow themselves to do it. So, and the reason was, that otherwise, if we waited for storing Y until X was loaded, or until if we waited to load X until Y was stored, we'd have to delay the load when it was already available. That's wasting time, and that's the idea of why the processor tries to do this. Though they could have said otherwise, that this is really confusing, I'm not going to do it, but that's not the decision every modern processor I know of has made. So, in fact, x86 has some rules at least. So most of the time you don't get this problem. So for example, each core, it sees its loads and stores as if they happen in the right order. So that's guaranteed. That when they reorder your loads and stores, if there's dependencies, they're gonna find them. They're saying you're accessing the same memory location, not gonna reorder that to make confusing results. And stores from other cores at least appear in a consistent order. So you're guaranteed that you're not going to see X and X is written then Y from one core, and then Y is written then X from another if the values are written externally. Like, it's always, like, if you update, say, the next pointer of a linked list and then its value, then always happens the same everywhere. And this causality restriction. But this is, like, really hard to reason about. We're not going to reason from these. The way we're actually going to get anything done on this system is by using special instructions which have ordering rules that are much stronger. Ordering rules which match your intuition of, when I run this instruction, everything before it is finished, before I move on. So we're going to have instructions like that, and that's what we're actually going to use when we need to talk between cores. And this is why, if you're writing multi-threaded code, you should use the locks that are supplied and not try to say, well, these writes can't really happen in that order, because processor manufacturers are really out to surprise you.